Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Aaron David Miller, who is a public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He has been an advisor to six secretaries of state, and under President Clinton served as the Deputy Special Middle East Coordinator for Arab-Israeli negotiations. His books include The Arab States and the Palestinian Question, The PLO and the Politics of Survival, The Search for Security, Saudi Arabian Oil and American Foreign Policy, The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace, and a new book out next year, Can America Have Another Great President? He also has an article in the latest issue of Foreign Policy titled Humpty Dumpty Palestine. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aaron David Miller.
Pleasure to be here.
And Palestinians apparently going to take their case for statehood to the United Nations Security Council on Friday. So with the U.S. veto expected, what would be the next step?
Well, it really depends what the Palestinians are prepared to do. If they come to the Security Council in seeking full U.N. membership, that requires a majority, and then any of the Perm 5 can veto it. I suspect that the United States will veto it. If they get an inkling, in fact, that not just the Americans but others, the Germans, for example, or the Brits and the French, might not support them, they may decide to go to the General Assembly and to seek enhanced status or a resolution supporting statehood, over which the United States really has no control. So I think this is clearly not their preferred option, but I think that they have so dug themselves into producing something in New York this fall that, frankly, there's no turning back.
But how do you think this will play on the so-called street if you have a situation where most of the world is in favor of a Palestinian state? And after all, we've recently had Sudan, Southern Sudan, and Kosovo accepted as member states, and the United States is the one roadblock. How's that going to play?
Well, it's going to play badly in the Arab and Muslim world for sure, but then our credibility is already much diminished and much reduced. I think the reality is, and everyone should understand this, that the reason this is happening is that the chances for a conflict-ending agreement pursued through negotiations between the current Israeli government and the current Palestinian Authority, the chances of it happening are slim to none. And that's the real problem. The issue is not what form of recognition the UN confers on the Palestinians, whether their status as a member state, as an entity, or a full non-observer member state. That's really not important. The reality is the day after, when all the hoopla and the ceremony have concluded and all the cheering has stopped, Palestinians and Israelis will still, particularly Palestinians, confront the same grim, potentially violent situation. And that's the real problem.
So the warning by the former head of Saudi intelligence, former Saudi ambassador to Washington, suggesting that Saudi Arabia and relations after the expected U.S. veto of Palestinian statehood would be irrevocably affected. Also, you have, of course, the Arab League meeting, and Turkey's prime minister has now taken a strong pro-Palestinian statehood stance there. That warning seemed a little blunt to me. What did you make of it from the Saudis?
The Saudis have been increasingly disenchanted, not just with our peace process policy, but with some of our policies across the board. As they confront the Arab Spring and the Arab Winter in places like Yemen and Bahrain. So I think that the U.S.-Saudi relationship has, the arc of that relationship has been on the downward slide for some time now. Clearly, the Saudis feel very strongly about the Palestinian issue, and they'll push. But the reality is the U.S.-Saudi relationship is too big to fail. I wouldn't be terribly worried about threats, frankly, right now on the part of the Saudis. Yes, they are disenchanted. Yes, you're going to hear a lot of nasty rhetoric. But the reality is both the Americans and the Saudis need one another.
But the Saudi intelligence chief, in his article in the New York Times, said that this would actually, a veto by the United States, would be a victory for Syria and Iran. And clearly there are tensions already between Hamas and Syria.
Well, there's no doubt that, first of all, there's no doubt the Iranians will make a lot out of a veto. There's no question about the Syrians. Bashar Assad had so many problems now. He's fighting for his political survival that I'm not sure this is, frankly, going to provide him much of a boost. The Syrian opposition is not going to be disenchanted or undermined by an American veto. Look, The reality is the President of the United States doesn't want to veto this, but if it comes to a push in the Security Council to admit Palestine as a member state, the President will veto. It cuts across 30 years of American policy that only through negotiations, however bleak the prospects may be, can Israelis and Palestinians sort out their differences. There's no way the United States is going to backtrack from that position. The other reality is that you also have very serious political constraints. This president has no desire, and there's no need, frankly, for a confrontation with the Israelis. So I think that is combining with longstanding American policy to almost guarantee a veto should the Palestinians push it. It's not a happy situation, but unless you end up with a softer landing than the General Assembly, I see no way to avoid a veto.
And Aaron David Miller, you don't think that Einstein's notion of doing the same thing repeatedly, and we've been doing this for 20 years, expecting a different outcome, is a definition of insanity?
I do agree with Einstein. He's a hell of a lot smarter than I am. But the reality is that under certain circumstances, the United States over the last 30 years has, in fact, been an effective broker. Henry Kissinger brokered 3 disengagement agreements, one of which between Israel and Syria has made the Israeli-Syrian border the quietest space in the entire Middle East. Jimmy Carter brokered an Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. Jim Baker brought the parties together at Madrid. Bill Clinton pursued some very high wire and very important diplomacy in the latter stages of the now-failed Oslo process. The reality is Israelis and Palestinians are not prepared to pay the cost of what would be required to push for a conflict-ending agreement. No American mediator, I don't care how determined, how principled, can overcome that basic obstacle if the Israelis and the Palestinians are not risk-ready and risk-averse. And that's the basic problem here. And they will only become risk-ready when there's sufficient pain on one hand and sufficient prospects of gain on the other to alter their notion that the status quo, altering the status quo, is somehow more risky for them or less risky than maintaining it. And that's the real problem. There is insufficient urgency right now to get the Prime Minister of Israel and the President of the Palestinian Authority into a different mindset. And until you do that, we're going to go nowhere very quickly.
And this, though, Aaron David Miller, is in a new landscape, surely, with the Arab Spring, with the growing isolation of Israel and a clear divisions between the Sunni kings and the Shiite regimes now in Iraq and Iran and to a lesser extent in Syria. I mean, in that broader context, you don't think there's a missed opportunity there, which is what the Saudi...
I don't, because let's translate this into something much more closer to home, and that is the stock market. In periods of certain uncertainty, you tell me, do people take major risks? The answer is no, they don't. And the reality is what the Arab Spring and now winter represents, and let's be clear what's happening. I mean, in Libya may have a happy ending, and Tunisia might as well, but in Egypt, things are very worrisome. In Yemen, things are very unsettled. In Syria, you've got the prospects of civil war. In Bahrain, you have repression. So the Arab Spring is turning into the Arab winter, and in that Arab winter, the space available for America to pursue its interests, given the fact that our policies toward Iran on counterterrorism, toward democratization, toward Israel, toward Gaza, toward Hamas, are opposed from one end of the Arab world to the other, the space available to America during the next several months and years is likely to continue to contract. So the question, forget America, the question is, an Israeli prime minister with the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty, which is the bulwark, the entire foundation of the structure of peacemaking over the last 4 decades in this region, if that's under threat, is it really viable that an Israeli prime minister is going to take risks on the Palestinian issue? And the answer is no. And no American president is going to push him to take those risks. What happened over the weekend in Cairo is worrisome, not just on the issue of Israeli-Egyptian relations. It's worrisome from the aspect of maintaining basic law and order and security in Cairo proper. And that's a serious problem these days. And it's led the military, the SCAF, to basically crack down and impose emergency regulations, again, which were supposed to have been lifted once Mubarak was forced out of power. So we're dealing with a situation in which risk-taking is very hard to imagine by just about anybody. The Palestinians are not going to take a risk. The Israelis are certainly not going to take a risk. Barack Obama has so many headaches at home. His what once was viewed as a more certain prospect for re-election has now been thrown wide open by a faltering economy. Nobody wants to take risks. And until people are ready to risk, the status quo is going to prevail.
But Aaron David Miller, the Israelis, and particularly Netanyahu, I think have made it pretty clear on any number of occasions that they view Iran as an existential threat, that that is not their principal enemy, their greatest concern. So it's just a little puzzling that an opportunity to diminish Iran's influence would not be something that both the United States and Israel would want to seize.
Well, I think they would if you could find a way. Look, you're not going to be able to force a duly elected government of Israel into a position that it believes, rightly or wrongly, correctly or incorrectly, is running against its own interests. And all I'm suggesting right now is that on the issue of the UN, which is where this our conversation started, Barack Obama has no choice, both in terms of consistency of American policy, American electoral politics, but to oppose the Palestinian initiative. It would be one thing if we were on the verge of a breakthrough in the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, but we're not. The gaps between Netanyahu and Abbas on borders, security, Jerusalem, refugees are very large. And this isn't something that has just appeared overnight. This has been the basic problem that no one has wanted to face up for a decade, since the Camp David summit.
That, of course, is what your article in Foreign Policy is telling us, the Humpty Dumpty Palestine. I mean, clearly the U.S. is going to be isolated, and when this happens, we're going to look like the bad guy in the eyes of the world. But what you're arguing in this article is that we should look at the state of Palestinian statehood before statehood, if you will, and you argue that the Palestinians are decentralized, dysfunctional, and divided, that there is 1 million Palestinians in Gaza who are more traditionalist, more Islamist, more oriented towards Egypt. You have 2.6 million Palestinians in the West Bank, which is also heavily occupied by the Israelis. Then you have 300,000 Palestinians in East Jerusalem. And then you have 5 million Palestinians in 58 refugee camps. And then you have 1.3 million Palestinians who are Israeli citizens living inside of Israel. And I take it they're all disparate.
Yeah, I mean, my point is you want to build a successful, effective, coherent national movement. You need control or monopoly over the forces of violence. You need monopoly over a political strategy. You need monopoly over resources. And the fact that the Palestinians have none of that. Abbas has done an amazing job with very little. There's no question about that. I'm simply pointing out the fact that a UN resolution, even if they could get in as member states, isn't going to change the basic reality that you have a divided, dysfunctional, and highly decentralized community. And to build a state out of this that will essentially be one gun, one authority, one negotiating position, under these circumstances is very, very difficult. We are not focused on the right things. We should be focused on whether or not we could actually figure out a way to get Israelis and Palestinians into a negotiation. And I'm not sure it's possible. I guess this is my point. Given the current leaderships on each side, who are not risk-ready but risk-averse, given the deep mutual suspicions that exist, and given the uncertainty in the region, it seems almost unimaginable to me, even without this UN gambit, which frankly is going to take us farther away from that goal, that you can see a two-state solution right now. And I wish it were not so, but it is so. And I think we're going to have to begin to base our post-UN strategy on how to preserve, how to preempt, and how to protect the prospects for a two-state solution, because the opportunity to pursue one is really shrinking. It's going to require Israeli leadership of heroic proportion. You do not have that. It will require ultimately a unified Palestinian polity. You do not have that. And it's going to require an enormous amount of support from Arab states who are now wrestling with questions of legitimacy and basic survival. The era of heroic politics in Israeli-Palestinian peacemaking and in Arab-Israeli peacemaking is diminishing. We don't have the Sadats. We don't have the King Husseins. We don't have the Rabins. We don't have the Ben-Gurions. We don't even have the Arafats in his first incarnation. And how you take these kinds of existential decisions from the perspective of the parties without that kind of bold and heroic leadership, men and women who are masters of their political houses, not prisoners of their constituencies, I don't have an answer to that question. But it is one that is going to need to be addressed if we're ever going to get anywhere.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Aaron David Miller.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Aaron David Miller, who is a public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He has been an advisor to 6 secretaries of state, and under President Clinton served as deputy special Middle East coordinator for Arab-Israeli negotiations. His books include The Arab States and the Palestinian Question, The PLO and the Politics of Survival, The Search for Security, Saudi Arabian Oil and American Foreign Policy, The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace, and a new book out next year, Can America Have Another Great President? He also has an article in the latest issue of Foreign Policy titled Humpty Dumpty Palestine. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about this new report on the growing numbers of people in this country living in poverty.
Just waiting for bread. Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?